You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our state is home to 11 turtle species, and this time of year, they're nesting, which means more of them are out on the roads, and that can create a hazard. In central Wisconsin, the state, the university, and a group of student so-called turtle wranglers have this creative solution. Rob Menser reports on an innovative turtle crossing project.
Below the highway, here on the outskirts of Stevens Point, there's another highway. It's used by mink, raccoon, skunk, the occasional house cat, but it wasn't built for any of them. It was built for turtles.
This is also where I've seen soft-shell turtles. Oh, there's a bunch of painted. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 painted turtles over there.
Leah Egan is a biology student at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. For a summer job a couple of years ago, she worked as a professional turtle wrangler. That is, she participated in a first-of-its-kind collaboration between the university and the state designed to give turtles an alternative way to cross Highway 66 near the Jordan Pond. It was the humans, she says, who got in the way.
The turtles are crossing the highway because they're trying to get to the river or to the pond or vice versa, and we built a road right in the middle of their path of travel.
The turtles out today aren't on the move. They're basking in the sun. But when they do move, especially during the June and July nesting season, they're at risk of being hit by cars.
Prior to there being a fence in place, there were as many as 66, almost 70 animals that were killed on that roadway, just turtles killed on that roadway.
That's UW Stevens Point biology professor Pete Zaney. The state considers any place with more than 50 turtle deaths in a year to be a hot spot. And besides being bad for turtles, they can be dangerous for drivers, too. In 2014, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Natural Resources together approached Zaney about how to help these turtles cross the roads safely. Their solution? A set of turtle-proof fences on either side of the highway and a tunnel underneath it.
So this is the Jordan Pond Dam, and then this is the hydroelectric...
A big part of the project, Zaney says, is something akin to turtle psychology. They had to think like turtles. For example, they had to make it clear to the turtles that this tunnel actually led somewhere. The team put grates on either side of the road above the tunnel so the sun would shine through, and they put bright reflective metal flashing at either end.
That is an attempt to create a light-colored background so that from the turtle's eye view, when they're looking across, they see sky and not dark green vegetation.
Zaney has been fascinated by reptiles for his whole life. He recalls being out at his grandfather's farm one day when he was 4 or 5 years old.
I caught an adult female snapping turtle that was on her nesting journey. And my grandfather proceeded to make soup out of it.
Zaney doesn't remember eating the soup. His interest in the creatures, though, that stuck. So when the state approached, of course Zaney helped with the turtle crossing project. With a $25,000 grant, he hired students like Egan to work as turtle wranglers. The students monitored the site and the fencing, they reviewed images from the trail cameras set up at either end of the tunnel, and they counted up turtles that didn't make it.
My dad always gave me a hard time that I was just scraping dead turtles off the road, but it was a lot more than that.
And as it turns out, there are fewer turtles dying on this stretch of road. This spring, Zaney presented a final report to the state. The number of turtles killed at the spot went from nearly 70 per year before the tunnel to between 10 and 20 after. DOT biologist Alyssa Barrett says her department is pleased.
No baby turtles were killed on the road in the first year, and that's a huge success for us. And then from a transportation standpoint, that means there's fewer turtles on the road and less risk to the public.
Barrett says the department will look for opportunities to use the project's lessons elsewhere. All it took was a clever design, a little wrangling, and someone willing to think like a turtle. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Rob's reporting there presents this opening for us to talk about how turtles are doing in Wisconsin. According to the DNR, ornate box turtles are endangered in our state, and the wood turtle is close. It's listed as threatened. So what do you want to know about how turtles are doing? Is there a turtle population near where you live? What have you learned about them? We're at 800-642-1234. Andrew Badgey is a natural heritage conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He coordinates the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we just heard that the DOT plans to apply what it's learned from this turtle crossing elsewhere. Do we know if there are any plans in the works from the DOT and the DNR to build more of these turtle crossings?
You know, I don't know of any specific sites right now. That would probably be more of a question for some of our DOT staff, especially Alyssa Barrett, who was on the interviewed in the earlier segment. The plan and the goal is to put more of these up, especially in the high mortality areas that volunteers have been submitting throughout the state for the past 7 years.
So how big of a threat are these road crossings to our turtle population overall?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it's something that's going to make species extinct, but it's a really big threat as far as what we're seeing with turtle declines in the state. It's probably one of the top two reasons for mortality, just because we do have roads crisscrossing the entire state in and around rivers and wetlands where we're getting a lot of turtles that like to come up and try and nest on the side of the roads. So it's definitely a very significant issue that the DNR is trying to get its hands around.
You, at the DNR, you have this turtle conservation program that is trying to address turtle crossings. How does this conservation program work?
Well, the program was initially started in 2012, in part due to the road mortality issue. And so how it works is we basically try and do outreach and education to the public. And during the nesting season each year, we're hoping to have the public report a lot of the road crossings for mortalities just when they're seeing live turtles. And it's also kind of evolved into a program, too, where it's also about just reporting nesting sites that we can help work to conserve over time, as well as just reporting general turtle sightings. And in turn, some of those can turn into new rare species populations that the DNR and biologists do not know about. So, it's a pretty cool program, and it's as simple as just submitting one road crossing a year for the public.
Where are some of these hot spots around the state where you see that turtles are more subject to be hit by cars?
I would say usually some of the really bigger ones are along the Mississippi River, along Highway 35, also along the lower Wisconsin River, kind of in Iowa County, Grant County, as well as on the north side of the lower Wisconsin River, too. And then the last one, which is probably the most significant, or at least the most historically well-known one, was Highway 49 that kind of juts through Horicon Marsh in the eastern part of the state. So all those areas that I've told you about are areas where there's at least 100 turtles getting hit on the road each year. So they're pretty big areas.
If you're driving, you see a turtle trying to cross the road, what do you do?
We usually want to make sure that people know to put their safety in addition, as well as the motorists' safety in the front of the situation, because we don't want anyone getting hurt. And after that, basically just pull over to the side of the road when it's safe to do so, and just help the turtle cross the road in the way that it's going. And if you're dealing with some of the bigger species like snapping turtles, sometimes it's just best to kind of usher them across the road the best you can. Otherwise, you can also try and grab them by the back of the shell and drag them across the road. The goal is also to try and not grab the turtle by the tail, because that can actually injure its spine. So
we're talking turtles with DNR Heritage Conservation Biologist Andrew Badgey, and you can join in 800-642-1234. Have you seen a turtle crossing a road in your area? What did you notice? What do you want to know about turtles in our state? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about turtles in Wisconsin, checking in on them here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Turtles are one of the most threatened vertebrate groups. Many species all over the world have experienced severe declines in recent years. Habitat destruction, road mortality, as we've been talking about, more nest predators, they're all impacting turtles in Wisconsin. Do you work with the DNR to help keep our turtle population protected? How do you get involved? How do you help turtles near your home? Join in at 800-642-1234. Biologist Andrew Badgey coordinates the State Turtle Conservation Program at the DNR, and he stays with us. So, Andrew, are the turtles that are in movement as they're crossing the road, are these females? Are these baby turtles as well? What would cause turtles to try to get from point A to point B?
Yeah, usually what we're seeing during this nesting season, so this year it was a little late. It usually happens throughout late May up until early July. However, this year is the nesting season really kind of started later. In the middle section of June, and it's still going on a little bit, but it's for the most part done. And yeah, a lot of what we're seeing during that time frame are females, and they're looking to move out of their wetlands and the rivers to uplands to lay eggs in either the sandy gravelly uplands or also along road shoulders. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of those. And unfortunately, too, that's also where we're seeing a lot of the mortality with females as well. And then throughout the rest of the year, you'll still see turtles crossing the roads less frequently because they're not all coming up at once. But they're just looking to move from wetland to wetland to just find something a little more suitable during the time frame. And then there are two time frames when you're typically seeing hatchlings heading back to the water or in the uplands. And that's usually also right away in fall, usually from August to September through October is when you see the first batch of nesting hatchlings that'll dig themselves out and head to the river. And then you'll see a second wave of a bunch of the species that actually overwinter in the nest. They kind of undergo some level of freezing. And then they come and dig themselves out in April and May, and then they head back to the wetlands. So there's usually two time frames for that, too.
What is the female's relationship like with her hatchlings? How long does she care for them?
You know, actually, turtles are one of the interesting species where they just lay the eggs and they head straight back to the water. The females really don't want to be out of the water that much, and they want to be in the safety of the wetlands. So there really is no care whatsoever outside of just laying the eggs and trying to protect them and keep the nest concealed during that laying experience.
So let's talk about our state's turtles in general. What do we know about the species of turtles that are here?
Well, we have 11 species of turtles, and one of them is considered a state endangered species, which is the ornate box turtle. That's about a softball-sized turtle, and it's found in our sand prairies. That one is also a strictly terrestrial species and actually overwinters in deep sand deposits. So it's also our most rare species, and that's the one that we really are working towards getting a handle on. And then we have another species, which is our state's threatened wood turtle, and that's a species that we've been doing a lot of work with as well, developing a conservation strategy for the species so we can work towards effective conservation measures. And in part, that's also going to go towards a federal assessment that the United States of America is going to undergo in about 2022 or 2023 to determine if that species warrants federal listing.
So this ornate box turtle is endangered. How did it get to that point? What is the cause of that?
Yeah, this is one species. It's a little more unique ecologically than our other species, just because it's strictly terrestrial. However, the big causes are what we believe to be just loss of habitat and habitat conversion. And so a lot of over time, a lot of these deep sand deposits have just either been developed into agricultural lands or have just kind of turned into more forested areas. And this is kind of a species that tends to like the open kind of sand prairie areas. And that's typically what's happening with this species and to a lesser extent, nest predation and a couple other things. But that's really the big one is habitat loss for the species.
Oh, so their habitats are shrinking, and that can really affect what happens to these turtles.
Yeah, correct. And part of that habitat loss, too, is also just the habitat getting constricted by roads. And again, you get more turtles on the roads, and that habitat gets disjunct, and one population can't necessarily reach the other one, and so forth. So,
the red-eared slider turtle is not native to our state. How did it get here?
Yeah, that's one species that's a little bit further south. It's found in as far north as central Illinois, but this species has kind of found a home in urban wetlands and rivers, and that's primarily because of the pet trade. So a lot of people, not everyone, but quite a few people over time just can no longer care for their pet turtle, and the red-eared slider is a pretty big one in the pet trade. And so either there's two things that typically happen is one, they'll either accidentally escape the owners and find their way into a wetland, or B, people just can't find a home for them, and so then they release them in some of these wetlands and urban parks, and so eventually over time in these areas they find each other and start breeding, and as of right now I wouldn't say they're a extremely invasive species, but they're one that's kind of taking over some of the basking sites for our native species like painted turtles and stuff. So they are kind of competing with our native species. And also they're also introducing potentially some different diseases that our native turtles aren't accustomed to.
Talking with Andrew Badgie, he is a natural heritage conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and he coordinates the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program. Andrew, do the turtles, does each species exclusively mate with its own species, or do you see any, cross mingling of the populations?
Most of our species typically mate with each other. I've only heard of one instance where a Blanding's turtle and a wood turtle have mated, and I haven't heard of that in Wisconsin, but I think that was in nearby Michigan, and that developed into a non-viable offspring, so it couldn't mate with others of each of the species. Basically, the eggs would just turn out to be infertile, so... So, for the most part, they're just mating with each other, but I guess accidents happen.
Do these species compete with each other in any way, or do they live pretty amicably in our state?
I would say for the most part, they live amicably. Some of the bigger turtles, however, like snapping turtles, they've been known to eat and prey on certain species, like, for example, the wood turtle, in the form of just kind of nipping off of legs and tails and also eating hatchlings, the younger turtles. So there is some level of competition, but for the most part, they're pretty cohesive with one another, and they're not really out competing one or the other.
Let's bring in Gary now from Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment that with our ever-increasing raccoon populations, that these raccoons predate on these turtle nests to a large extent. And I think that my own personal opinion is that there's probably more turtles lost to nest predation by raccoons than there are killed on highways. And I'd also like to ask your reptile expert about the habitat for our native lizards and skinks that are, these habitats are being lost because of increased rainfall in these dry, sandy habitats are turning to trees and brush, and so the habitat for a lot of these species, including the ornate box turtle, are continually shrinking, and I'm wondering what possible options there are to help save these species.
Gary, thanks. Andrew, let's start with raccoons first.
Yeah, raccoons, and Gary touched upon it, raccoons and foxes, possums, all those what we consider mesopredators, they're all really subsidized by our human population. And so as a result, those numbers have just increased substantially and to the point where, yeah, we are losing a lot of nests that historically would have made it. And you may have guessed it too, Gary, but yeah, usually turtles rely on numbers. They've always had nest predation, but at the same time, the bigger the population, the more successful nests can come out of them. So, but at the same time, yes, you're right. That is definitely one of the top two reasons for declines in turtle numbers in the state for sure.
Very quickly, before we have to let you go, where can people go if they want to report turtle sightings to the DNR?
Yes, people can go on a search engine like Google or Bing and type in Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program, and that'll take you right to our website. And there's a nice little tab right on the homepage that you can click to submit your turtle sighting. And we'll take any and all observations. Every report does go somewhere, and it doesn't just go into a black void. So we appreciate everything you guys can submit.
Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
Andrew Badgey is a natural heritage conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and he coordinates the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program. Coming up, we talk about the debate over removing federal protections for gray wolves. We'll be back after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a federal proposal to remove gray wolves from the endangered species list and turn the management of wolf populations over to states. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The public comment period ends Monday. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed this rule in March that would lead to the hunting and trapping of wolves in the lower 48 states. So what do you think the right population number should be for wolves here in Wisconsin? What do you think should be done to prevent wolf attacks on livestock? Join in with your thoughts, your reactions, 800-642-1234. Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison, and he founded the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Adrian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
So you reviewed the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's evidence for taking wolves off the endangered species list. What are some of the agency's main arguments for doing this?
Right. So by the Endangered Species Act, the agency is required to impanel five peer reviewers, five scientists coming at it from different angles. And all five of us approached their proposal from very different biological or the human dimensions of the problem. Their main argument is that wolves are secure in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and that no other areas of the country are that important to the survival of the species in the USA, excluding, of course, the Northern Rocky Mountains wolves, which were not part of that proposal.
So in the Pacific Northwest, wolves aren't doing as well as they're doing here in the Midwest?
That's correct. Yeah, in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, there's what I think of as sort of a fledgling population just established recently.
Why is that?
Well, it takes time, and the major cause of mortality for wolves are humans. And among the human causes of mortality, the worst cause is poaching or illegal killing. And that's true of all of the wolf populations that are we've studied over the years, all of them endangered. So all of them protected by the Endangered Species Act, and yet illegal killing is the major cause of wolf deaths. So recovery can be very slow. Sometimes it can stall completely, as we saw with red wolves in North Carolina.
What factors then outweigh those points in your view? Why should wolves be kept on the endangered species protections?
Oh, because the law, the Endangered Species Act, requires that before delisting a species, it must have recolonized or recovered in a significant portion of its range. And so at the moment, it's less than 15% of the historic range of gray wolves. And there are vast areas, including the southern Rocky Mountains and the state of Colorado, vast areas that contain suitable habitat for wolves that are currently empty or have just the occasional dispersing wolf traveling through there, often getting killed by somebody. So there are also areas throughout most of the states of our union where wolves could live. And our public opinion surveys here in Wisconsin, as well as some nationwide surveys by Ohio State University, suggest that a large number of people in many states would welcome the recovery of wolves in their area.
How much of a concern is poaching if wolves are taken off the endangered species list? What would happen?
Well, I believe it's a huge concern because for the 3 years that they were taken off the list here in Wisconsin, we saw an incredible increase in mortality of wolves. Much of that was legal, but a large proportion that isn't measured well was illegal killing. So we had more than half of the radio-collared wolves in Wisconsin disappear the very first year that they were taken off the federal list. And our agencies had not been doing a very good job of measuring that poaching, keeping track of it, or estimating the effect it's having on population growth. There's kind of a perception that wolves recovered despite poaching, so it's okay, but poaching is an environmental crime. It's stealing from the public by a few individuals who are basically acting lawlessly. It goes against Wisconsin's traditions of law-abiding wildlife management.
We're discussing whether gray wolves in Wisconsin should stay on the endangered species list, and UW-Madison professor Adrian Trevis is with us. You can join in our conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think wolves should be kept on the endangered species list or be returned to state management? Share your questions, your stories about wolves here in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Melissa joining us from Minocqua. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning. We have a small hobby farm, and it's not common, but it's not infrequent that we hear the wolves and occasionally see them. But a couple years ago, we had one that had gotten some of our birds, and the wolf would go during the day through a neighbor's yard who had young children and never did anything, but it was disconcerting. So the wolf had gotten some of our birds, and we had called the DNR not to have it killed, but to have it moved or trapped or something, and I had a picture of it. We had scat with feathers. And the DNR said, we can't do anything without a carcass. Well, how are you supposed to get a carcass from a wolf? And we were all so frustrated. And the problem is then people start taking it into their own hands, which I have the willow pack by me, and I cannot tell you how many people, whether they're on an endangered species list or not, will kill the wolves.
Melissa, thank you for your call and that situation that you described. How common is that?
Thanks for your call, Melissa, and sorry for your loss. As far as I'm aware, the agency can intervene based on the evidence you described if they're able to inspect that evidence and verify it, confirm it the way you were. These are not very common across the whole area of farming in Wisconsin. But of course, it can affect individual farms and farmers. It can be quite serious and concerning for them. So there are a variety of non-lethal methods to protect one's domestic animals or even to keep wolves out of one's property, if that's a concern, short of killing the wolves. Most people, as you know, manage coexistence with wolves in northern Wisconsin without resorting to lethal methods. But you're right, there are a lot who are going to simply take the events into their own hands and illegally kill those wolves. And there's almost never investigation or prosecution of those events. And so it's something of an invisible crime going on out there.
As Melissa said, can you actually trap the wolf and move it to a different location? Because wolves, they travel hundreds of miles.
Wolves do travel hundreds of miles. I wouldn't recommend a private citizen attempting to live trap a wolf and relocate it, and it would probably just come back. So for a long time, the DNR did do translocation, and they would move wolves hundreds of kilometers. That wasn't a very successful program, and it was hugely expensive and time-consuming, but it did satisfy those with concerns about their domestic animals or fears for human safety, which are extremely rare in our state. So the methods that are recommended for avoiding any kinds of conflicts with wolves non-lethally are electric fencing, livestock guarding dogs, which are special breeds, not your ordinary breeds of dogs, and something called fladry, which is it's a Polish word. It refers to a kind of a visual deterrent, a flagging hung from fence lines. And it seems to be effective for a time and coupled with human supervision seems to be very effective in keeping wolves away from an area.
Let's bring in Jack now from Caledonia. Hi, Jack.
How are you guys today?
Doing well. What's on your mind about the wolves?
Just how does it affect the deer population in the various areas, you know, whether it's in Wisconsin or, you know, out in the Rockies? Or
thanks for that question, Jack. So at the height of the wolf population, there is an estimate that annually about 25,000 deer would be eaten by the wolves. And just for comparison, to put that in perspective, about twice that number are killed by our vehicles on the roads every year, and 10 times that number or more are killed by human hunters every year. So one can see a local effect of a large predator on deer. The deer are going to be scared, skittish, change their habits, move to different places. But it's not having a major regulating effect on the whole deer population across the state. And also we have to bear in mind how much human activity, how much human behaviors change our deer. So we have a damage and compensation program here in the state for farmers. A lot of deer get killed to protect crops like cranberries and such. And our amazing hunting population, our tradition of hunting deer every fall, right, is removing hundreds of thousands of deer and using different methods than our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers might have used. Things like baiting has changed and so forth.
What do we know about the impact to livestock from the gray wolf population?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the data are much better from before 2012, before the first delisting time. And at that time, less than 1% of farms across Wisconsin were affected. Even across northern Wisconsin, it was less than 1%. And other causes like disease, weather, and accidents are far more serious for livestock owners than predators are in general. And among predators, wolves, simply because there are a small number of them, cause fewer problems than, say, coyotes or bears. So I'm not minimizing the problem, but we have to put it in perspective when we're talking about state policy.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is debating whether to remove gray wolves from protections under the endangered species list, and their management would then return to states and tribal nations. Public comment period ends Monday. Adrian Trevis stays with us. He's a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison. Would you support another wolf hunt here in Wisconsin? Should federal protections be lifted on gray wolves? Why or why not? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a proposal to delist wolves from the federal endangered species list as the public comment period ends Monday. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is one of about a dozen states to have a wild gray wolf population. Gray wolves were once almost extinct in the lower 48, and now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is calling them one of the greatest comebacks for any animal. There are about 900 gray wolves here in Wisconsin, more than 2,600 in Minnesota from the last federal count. Would you support another wolf hunt in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about the population here? We're at 800-642-1234. And UW-Madison professor Adrian Trevis is with us, and he founded the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Let's go back to the phones now with Norm joining us from Oneida County. Hi, Norm.
Good morning. Several things here. When they did have a hunting season on wolves, one year there were 257 wolves killed, and they don't know how many were killed illegally. The other thing is we think a lot of people feel the population will level off. Wolves are very territorial, and there's only so many territories to go around. And one last thing here, there's a group called the Threatened Species List. That means they're off the endangered species list, they're on the threatened species list, and Wildlife Services would then have the authority to take out problem wolves, but there would not be a hunting season on wolves. We are strongly against the hunting season on wolves.
Norm, thanks for the call. He brings up several issues there, Adrian.
Thanks for joining us, Norm. Yeah, as far as I know, you've got the numbers right, and you're correct about the threatened species status under the Endangered Species Act. That would give more flexibility to states and tribes to, say, contract with wildlife services or to work with another agency to remove those rare problem wolves that are causing chronic problems or threatening human safety. So one avenue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service might have followed was to change the listing of wolves in the lower 48 states to threatened, but they chose to jump all the way to delisting, complete removal of federal protections, which we know from past experience will lead to hunting trapping seasons and a big uptick in those problem animal control actions, which are lethal typically under wildlife services. It also seems to be associated with an uptick in poaching or illegal killing. And therefore, I looked very carefully at the science the Fish and Wildlife Service presented about human-caused mortality, both legal and illegal, across the nation and historically, and I found serious gaps in the science. The Fish and Wildlife Service ignored some of the best available science and simply presented its apparently preferred view that wolves would be just fine without federal protections. And in my scientific judgment, they had a preconceived notion, a preconceived conclusion, and they tried to bend the science to fit that.
Well, let's talk the numbers here. We know there were around 950 wolves that roamed Wisconsin last winter, according to the recent numbers from the DNR. That's up slightly from the previous year. We've got numbers out of Minnesota that looking at about 2,600 wolves there. How has the wolf population changed in Wisconsin historically?
Well, I'm going to be a little bit ornery, like, you know, most folks in Wisconsin are at times when we talk about numbers of wildlife. Those counts cannot be verified, and the count in Minnesota is equally questionable. There are huge confidence bounds on that, meaning that the range of possible numbers of wolves in Minnesota by a, you know, pretty simple calculation that I published for the Fish and Wildlife Service, pretty simple calculation has them lower than 1,251 wolves in Minnesota. Could be much higher than they're saying, but the way they count is very imprecise. Here in Wisconsin, scientists are unable to verify the accuracy of the wolf count ever since 2012, when the system for counting our wolves in our state changed and became much less transparent. Before 2012, I had more confidence in the wolf counts, although there's, you know, the usual kind of a little bit of imprecision here and there, some minimum and maximum estimates. We had more confidence before 2012. And then with the change of administration and a reduction in transparency that supposedly was because of poaching for wolves, turns out that that transparency made it harder for scientists, that lack of transparency made it harder for scientists to verify the count and harder for scientists to study poaching.
Let's talk about territory for a moment. What is the gray wolf habitat looking like here in Wisconsin? Because we know territory is a big issue for wolves.
Well, wolves are habitat generalists. So around the world, they can live from the, you know, the Arctic, the tundra, boreal forests, all the way down to deserts like the South U.S. Southwest. So they're habitat generalists. They generally tend to avoid people. They're quite shy of people and elusive. So places where they're running into a lot of roads, a lot of structures and a lot of people, they're going to tend to avoid those because of our history of persecuting wolves. But apart from that, we see them pretty much occupying any area where there's suitable prey, which is white-tailed deer in our region. And so we have about half the state unoccupied by wolves. And there are many other states near us that could host packs of breeding wolves if the, you know, regulatory framework were made suitable, or people were tolerant of the wolves. They could recolonize areas of Illinois, Iowa, the Dakotas, the lower peninsula of Michigan. So I don't really think the wolves are running out of range. What they're running out of is the tolerance of people to allow them to settle in those areas. And part of that is, some of that's changing with changing societal values towards nature. Some of it's changing with the regulatory system states have in place, but not fast enough. And what we see with delisting is that those hunting and trapping seasons and the liberal lethal control programs that the states implemented, that reduces the ability of wolves to recolonize new areas. So there's vast swaths of the U.S. where the public cannot see wolves in their own state as a result of policies such as Wisconsin's hunting and trapping season.
Adrian, let me ask you this. How long have you been studying wolves, and what fascinates you about them?
I've been working on wolves for 20 years here in Wisconsin, and I've interviewed folks. I've studied wolves on the ground with the wolves themselves, but also the people who coexist with them. I'm fascinated in how we act and talk about coexistence with wolves. There's a huge gulf between what one hears, say, over the radio from the people who are called on to speak about it versus what the average person on the street or out in the farm might say. I was amazed in interviews with 42 Wisconsin farmers. These are beef cattle producers, small family farms generally. In interviews with 42 of them, only one of those farmers wanted wolves eradicated from the state. Every other farmer said, I'm okay with our native predators living on this landscape, or even saying, those are beautiful animals, I want them out there. They're unanimous, of course, that they don't want their beef calves killed by the wolves. But the extremes we sometimes hear in the public policy debate is not the reality on the ground. And I would just like Wisconsin's public and the reality on the ground to be heard a little bit more often.
As we start to wrap up here, what is the next step in this process? We know the public comment period closes Monday, and then what happens?
Yeah, if I could encourage your audience to write, it's easy, it's online. You can just express your opinion, whether you support listing or support delisting. Very easy to do. Perhaps the radio station could post the link. I'm not sure if there's an online companion to this. So the next step is the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, has to decide if it's going to move ahead with its proposed rule. In other words, is it going to delist gray wolves officially? That usually takes maybe a few months, but they may also pull back from the proposal. In my opinion, all five of the scientific peer reviewers found major shortcomings in the science behind the proposed rule. So I would encourage the Fish and Wildlife Service to go back, do their homework again, do it properly, and really work on a nationwide recovery plan for wolves before they jump to any conclusion. So we'll see what'll happen. It could go either way, pulling back the proposal and wolves will remain under federal protections, or the Trump administration may choose to go forward with it, at which point I predict they'll get sued.
Adrian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison, founded the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Just ahead, the newly signed state budget boosts funding for respite care in Wisconsin, the first increase in 20 years. We'll look at the state of respite care and how the new funds will be put to use. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.